Something was preventing her from moving on. The gun. She'd picked up the gun. She was loading it. No! The gunfire was inside the building now. Watts roared in desperation. He dug his fingers into the tiny gap at the edge of the door. There was no handle to grip. He would make one with his hands. He screamed his need. Steel bent under his fingers. Steel gave, millimeter by millimeter. He could feel Lunara on the other side of the door. Her gun was pointed up the stairs, waiting. Fear paralyzed her. He would make it through this door. He'd get her out of here, get them both out. He felt the bullets rip through her body before he heard them, felt the icy pain lance through her before he felt the impacts on the door he gripped. They'd gone through her as if through paper. It took his breath away. He heard Marines yelling. He could feel Lunara's life slipping away. He could feel her clinging to the Buddhism her Uyghur mother had brought from Mongolia, feel her clinging to the hope of rebirth, feel her hoping she'd improved her karma, that her next trip on the great wheel of being would be less filled with pain.
No!
Stand back from the door!
Watts couldn't comprehend it. He kept digging his fingers into the steel, kept squeezing, kept trying to get a grip that he could use to force it open. They blew the hinges off. The door exploded inward, bearing him to the ground, slamming his head into the stone floor. Then there was a Marine Corps medic above him, shining a light into his eyes, yelling into his face.
Can you hear me? Sergeant Cole, can you hear me? Are you hit? Are you injured?
He could feel Lunara. She was still alive. She was in pain. She was weak and getting weaker. But she was still alive. There was still hope. He opened his mouth, tried to get the words out, tried to tell the medic. Then, from beyond the doorway,
Hey, this one's still breathing.
The sound of a single gunshot, louder than all the automatic fire before. Lunara's mind disintegrated in a final peal of agony.
Fucking bitch, no one messes with the Corps.
They were coming for him, the Corps, his brothers. He could hear the choppers. At 5:39 a.m., a chime went off. Watts rose with a jolt. He was drenched in sweat. Someone downstairs pounded on his floor. Had he been screaming again? The dream. Lunara. It was getting worse. A chime. A message. He splashed cold water from the sink onto his face to wash away the horror, then checked his slate. It was a note and a set of photos from his man at the Prince Market Hotel. Cade and Katarones had returned to the hotel. They both looked rumpled and worse for wear. There was a livid bruise across the side of Cade's face. Two bulky-looking Thai gentlemen with crew cuts had checked in shortly thereafter. He sat down heavily on the bed. He'd slept little, and what sleep he'd gotten had been its own torment. The urge to drug himself into dreamless unconsciousness was strong, but this was not the time for that. What had he done to earn so much suffering in this life? What had he done that he had the memory of Lunara's death, of her rapes, of Armand's pain at discovering the slaughter of his family, of Tamir's pain at the pillaging of his village, of the pain of all the men and women they'd trooped through that cellar and trooped through his mind? What had he done that he had the torment of so many seared into his soul? Watts dismissed the question. He knew very well what he'd done. He'd killed countless men and not a few women. He'd used violence as a weapon. He'd hurt and killed people for no reason other than the words of his superiors. He'd enjoyed it. It didn't matter that he'd believed what he was doing was right. He'd sewn the mask over his own eyes. He'd been complicit in his own exploitation as a tool of evil. His karma was black as night. A dozen lifetimes might not be enough to climb his way out of the pit he'd dug for himself in this one life. The data fob was in his hand, the metal of the chain coiled in his palm. So small. If he could just connect this to Cade. He'd been so close to doing something that could make a dent in his vile karma, that could help redeem him just a tiny bit, so close to be turned away. Watts dragged himself out of the mire of self-pity. It was beneath him. He was here for a reason. He looked at the message on the slate again, at the images. He pieced together the events of the night before. Someone had tried to abduct Cade. Katarones had fought them off. They'd spent time in a safe house somewhere, Now they were back, and they were keeping those spec ops types close. Security around Cade would be tighter than ever. He should have made his move the first day. He should have shot Cateranes in the head last night and hauled Cade away. They could be in Laos by now. Watts sighed. Freeing Cade would be harder than ever at this point. It would be a suicide mission. He couldn't succeed. Not on his own. But he wouldn't give up. Not yet. Someone else wanted Cade. Someone else had tried to abduct him. He wanted to know who. He wanted to know why. He pictured the monk he'd seen twice now. He had one lead. 28. Warnings and discoveries. Cade woke to the sound of the alarm. With a groan, he reached across the bed to slap it off. The clock read 11 a.m. His poster session was at 1 o'clock. The sound of the shower emanated from behind the closed bathroom door. Sam was in there. She'd slept on the floor in Cade's room. A bodyguard he wished he didn't need, wished he could be rid of. He could feel her mind, calm, thinking about the day, washing herself methodically. He didn't think she could feel him yet. Cade rolled onto his back and stared at the ceiling. Weak light filtered through the crack between the hotel room curtain and the wall. In addition to Sam, he knew that there were two of the guys with guns in the hotel now as well, posing as Thai businessmen, covertly ready to intercept assailants and leap to Sam and Cade's aid should anything happen. He was as safe as he was going to get. Others weren't so lucky. Narong and his friends, Juan, Lalana, Saja. He knew what he needed to do. He remembered something Watts had said after a few drinks once, talking about a no-win situation he and his squad had found themselves in, deep in the mountains of Kazakhstan. A decision of whether or not to try to rescue a captured squad mate against impossible odds. When the chips are down, when you have to weigh what you believe in against your own safety, that's when you find out what you're made of. Cade knew what he believed in. He believed that Narong and his friends were doing nothing wrong. He needed to warn them, have them call off Friday night. He glanced at the door to the bathroom. It was still closed. The shower was still going. How long had Sam been in there? Was she about to pop out? He had to take the chance. He was tired of being passive. He had to make the right thing happen. Cade kept his mind as blank as he could, reeled in the amount he was emanating, rolled off the bed, padded as quietly as he could in boxers and bare feet to the small desk, found the stationery and pen, jotted a quick note. Robin Rodriguez is a narc. You must cancel Friday night or uninvite us. You didn't hear this from me, please. The noise of the shower ended. He pulled the top sheet off the pad, folded it up, scanned around frantically for his pants. The bathroom door opened. He looked up in time to see Sam crossing the distance between them, her face livid. Her open palm knocked him to the floor before he even saw it coming. His world exploded in pain. The room spun around him. You stupid son of a bitch! She was standing above him, naked, water dripping off her, fists clenched. She was going to hit him again. He held his breath. I warned you, she told him. There was a scar below her left collarbone and above one perfect breast, a long line of red against her olive skin. A knife wound? Surgery. There were circular pockmarks on her otherwise flat stomach, more above one knee. Bullet wounds. Her nipples were hard. Was she cold? Did this excite her? What was she? He spat out blood, tried to talk. It's not their fault. They're not doing anything wrong. She kicked him in the stomach. He curled into a ball of agony, unable to breathe. I trusted you, Cade. I went to bat for you. I saved your fucking life. And what do you give me? Just pathetic lies, again and again and again. He gasped for breath, tried to speak. Tried to do right thing. Fuck your right thing, Cade. I'm tired of your lies. If anything about Friday night goes wrong, we're going to assume you sabotaged it. Got it? Anything goes wrong and you're in an internment camp for life. You and your stupid fucked up party friends. Dozens of them. You hear me? Cade tried to speak. Nothing came out. He nodded meekly instead. Watts bowed respectfully to the woman who opened the monastery door. This was his fifth attempt today. The woman took a look at him, his skin color, his clothes, his height, his musculature, and addressed him in English.
May I help you?
Her accent was quite good. Watts responded in his best tie, as weak as that was.
Please, honored sister, I'm looking for a monk. I had the honor to serve food to him from my humble stall yesterday. He forgot his alms bowl with me. I would return it to him.
She frowned at him, replied in Thai.
There are many monks, friend. If one has lost his alms bowl, it can be easily replaced.
Please, honored sister.
He bowed again.
This monk blessed my humble stall. I would feel honored to be able to return his lost possession to him.
Very well. What does he look like?
Watts rose up out of his bow.
He is tall.
He held his hand at temple height.
Nearly as tall as me. Perhaps 1.8 meters. Not young, but not old. He has sharp features, a large nose with a hook.
His hands molded the image in the air as he spoke.
He is Thai?
Yes, honored sister.
She thought for a moment.
That is very tall for a Thai man. We do not have a monk that tall in this monastery.
Watts contained his disappointment. There were many more places to try.
But,
she continued,
I may know who this monk is. Where is your food stall?
Off Jai Pratan, honored sister, east of the Chapor Sua Shrine.
Ah, near the convention center.
Yes, honored sister.
She nodded.
Then I may know who this monk is. It may be Prarachakana Chanron Tuksin.
Watts nodded to himself. The title indicated that this Tuksin was only one step below Somdet status, a very senior monk. He nodded, repeated the name to be sure he had it right, then used the colloquial title,
Chan Prom Tuksin. Thank you, honored sister.
She nodded at him.
Where would I find Chan Prom Tuksin, honored sister?
He resides at the Wat Hua Lampong, near Chulalongkorn University. He is special assistant to Professor Somdet Prananda.
Watts nodded again. This went close to the top indeed.
Thank you again, honored sister.
He brought his hands together in a respectful Y to her, turned to go.
What food does your stall serve, young man?
He turned back to her.
American food, honored sister. Hot dogs and hamburgers.
She frowned at him.
That is not fitting food to offer a monk,
she scolded.
But you earn much merit in going so far to return his bowl.
Thank you, honored sister.
He bowed his head, made the Y to her again.
Sawadee, traveler.
Sawadee, honored sister.
29. Madness Everywhere. A taxi driven by one of the armed Thai military types took Cade and Sam to the conference after lunch. Cade stood near his poster on mouse-to-mouse spatial memory sharing via machine-learning-mediated nanoprobe connections. The growth factors had nearly healed the bruise on his face. What little remained was covered in concealer. He could see Sam hovering around, pretending to view the other posters. She felt tense and alert through the link. Two more of the men from the safe house orbited around in shirts and blazers. God knew what tucked away underneath there. They made a show of looking at posters. The crowd came and went. Students and professors made comments, asked questions. Cade fielded them as quickly as he could, repeating himself again and again, constantly thronged. It was clear his poster was making waves. He wished for a glimpse of Narong in the crowd. There wasn't. Saja came by, admired Cade's poster. Cade wished he had the note in his pocket, wished he had some way to warn them.
Have you seen Narong? He asked Saja.
I think he's sick,
the other student said.
Didn't show up with his poster today. It must be really bad for him to miss his poster session.
Cade nodded. Not that I could have warned him, he thought. More professors and students came and went. An hour passed, and then another visitor arrived.
Heads up. Shoe en route. Don't do anything stupid.
Cade felt the Nexus bridge to Sam go down. He looked up at the crowd, and there she was, Su Yong Shu. He could barely see her through the throng in front of his poster. Elegant and stately as ever, going from poster to poster, taking her time, smiling and saying encouraging things to the students.
"Save me from the ERD,"
he wanted to tell her, but then he would just be someone else's slave. He was fielding a question when the crowd parted and Shu stepped through. Everyone went silent. Her eyes touched on the concealed bruise on his temple, and her expression changed immediately.
"Cade,"
she said,
"what happened? Are you hurt?"
Shu asked him. He touched his temple, smiled ruefully.
"I got mugged late last night. It was no big deal. They just took a little bit of cash."
He heard people react, whisper about it.
A mugging. "We're being observed,"
he sent her.
"They know we communicated via Nexus last night."
Shu's eyes went far away for a moment, then snapped back to reality.
"Walk with me."
"My session goes until 4 o'clock, Professor."
"It will wait,"
she pronounced. Then to the crowd around them,
"Please forgive me. I'll bring him back shortly."
And then she was leading him by the hand through the stunned throng. A murmur went through them. Su Yong Shu had just snapped him away. She led him away towards the cafeteria. He could see Sam and one of the military types watching out of the corner of their eyes. But what could they do? His assignment was to get close to Su Yong Shu. They ordered tea, sat at a table near the window.
"So," she said, "tell me about your schedule. When could you be free for a week or so to visit? And do you know Rangan's schedule as well?"
Cade started to walk her through the experiments they had planned for the rest of the year, when there might be a hole. A moment later, he felt her in his mind.
"Open to me. Show me what happened,"
she sent. He could feel her mind touching his in other ways, weaving a false set of memories to cover their conversation even as they spoke.
"Are we being watched?"
he asked.
"You are bugged, but they will not detect our real conversation. Not this time."
Cade waxed poetic about the need to book lab time months in advance and how that would affect his calendar for the rest of the year.
"I have a lot to learn,"
he sent her.
"Yes, you do. Now, show me."
He did. She absorbed it in an instant.
"I did not do this thing,"
she told him. He felt a cold, vast anger inside her. The attack on him offended her. It made her furious.
"I know," he replied. "You could have taken me any time you wanted." "Someone wants to make you a slave,"
Shu told him.
"Someone wants your secrets."
"Do you know who?" he asked her.
"No, but I intend to find out."
"Could it be Professor Ananda?" Cade asked. "He's one of their other suspects." She mentally shook her head.
"Not Ananda."
"Or Ted Pratnung?" he asked. Shu looked at him sidelong this time. He caught a sense of something.
"Not Tanom."
They talked logistics out loud for a time. Flights, lodging, who to meet, Rangan's schedule.
"Can you help me about Friday?"
he asked her.
"Help me warn them, some way that the ERD doesn't find out." "Your government has made you a slave, Cade. If you want my help, come with me now to Shanghai. Break free of these chains."
The temptation was strong. To have a mentor he could trust, that he could turn to work towards real goals and not spend all his time hiding them. But he would be a slave there, too. He would be making weapons. There would be blood on his hands.
"I'm sorry,"
he sent her.
"I can't accept the price you pay." "I won't pay that price forever, Cade. There will come a day when we will be free and the humans will no longer have us under their thumbs."
She had so much anger inside. She hated them. He caught a flash of her mentor, Yang Wei, burning to death. She watched him die, he realized.
How would that affect me?
He shook it off. It didn't matter.
"I'm sorry," he sent her. "This isn't just my life on the line. There are more than 100 people whose futures are at stake. I can't let them down." "They're humans,"
she sent him.
"You're more valuable. You're wasting your potential."
"I'm human too."
"You're more, Cade. You're transhuman now, and you can be so much greater still."
"Everyone could be greater," he sent. "This is about choice and freedom, right? About everyone's potential."
"The world needs leaders, Cade,"
she sent him.
"After we tear down the old order, there will be a vacuum. Who will rule? Giving full power to everyone would be like putting guns in the hands of children. In time, we'll uplift some,
but I need a core group of people like you to fill that initial void. You will always be one of the elite.
Ruling, he replied. One of the elite.
There is no other way,
she said. Who decides who gets to be part of that elite? He asked her.
Who decides which people get uplifted? Whoever takes the initiative, Cade. Whoever wins the war to come. I intend that to be me. You can be on the winning side.
He saw it through her eyes. The old men that ruled her country and his on their knees, giving way to the new order, or burning, dying, everywhere burning. It was too much. Head reeling, he stumbled to his feet, backed away from her. He mumbled some word of farewell aloud. Her disappointment followed him. He turned and shambled in a daze back towards his poster. He felt her web of false memories knit itself shut around the conversation they'd just had. He hardly cared. Her final thoughts followed him.
One day you'll see the truth, Kate. The humans are the enemies of the future. They hate us. They hate our beauty and our potential. Either they hunt us down and kill and enslave us, or we rise above them and take our rightful place in this world. There are no other options.
Madness. Madness everywhere. The ERD would make him a slave. Shu would make him a tyrant and a killer. He had to find some other way. 30. Data gathering. Wat slid slowly out of the shadow of the inner wall of Wat Hua Lumpong. It was the hour of evening meditation, between dinner and sleep, and the monks had all been called to the central hall. Golden Buddhas watched him with serene, lifeless eyes. Their half-smiles mocked him. Red-faced guardian demons leered at him. A giant statue of the Hindu elephant god Ganesha watched him pass with alien indifference. He'd watched the small number of monks' rooms all evening, had seen Tuxin enter and exit one near the end. This was a city temple, more for worship by the laity than for monks, but a few dwelled here. Tuxin and Ananda both had small cells, close to Chulalongkorn University, where Ananda worked and taught during the week. Ananda's home monastery lay to the northeast, he knew, 100 or so clicks out of town, up in the mountains. Watts crept silently, slowly forward, moving at a pace the chameleon wear could accommodate. Too fast and no technology could camouflage you. The key was patience. And luck. He remained alert to lights and motion. A sister passed by 4 feet away from him, heading from one place to another on some errand, oblivious to his presence. He froze while she passed, moved again when she had rounded a corner. Finally, he came to the door that he'd watched Tuxin enter and exit. He tried the knob with gloved hands. It was locked. He slid the small auto pick from his thigh pocket, inserted its matte black length into the lock. It whirred softly as it felt its way within the lock, shifted its shape to fit. Then a click. He turned the auto pick and the knob turned with it. Watts entered the cell, closed the door silently behind him. He dared not turn on a light. Instead, he scanned the room with the electromagnetic senses of his goggles. Night vision revealed a small, Spartan space, a narrow bed against one wall, a writing desk with an outdated terminal, a phone resting beside it, a bookshelf with a few texts in Thai and English, a wardrobe, a sink, no bathroom door. The only transmissions in the room came from the phone and the terminal. He moved forward, slid a probe into a port on the phone, let it do its work. There was a thumbprint sensor on the side of the phone. He slid a print imager across it. As a precaution, he did the same with the thumbprint sensor attached to the terminal, went to the doorknob, did it a third time. As the probe cloned the phone's data, he searched the wardrobe. Monk's robes, sandals, underwear, a cloak with a hood, no hidden back or bottom. The probe beeped softly. Watts extracted it, slid a different tip into the terminal. He lifted the mattress, 2 boxes beneath the bed. One held old-fashioned photographs, a young man in a village, Tuxin, before he was a monk. The other held closed-toe shoes. He felt the top surface of the mattress, nothing. He felt along the sides, nothing. He felt along the bottom, There, a change in consistency. He explored it, found a place where he could part the fabric and slide his hand in, pulled out a large, opaque package, soft-sided, waterproof. Within it, business attire. Pants and a button-down shirt. A wallet with tens of thousands of baht in it and paper bills. A wig, short black hair, conventional-looking. So, Tuxin liked to dress up like a layperson sometimes. Interesting. The probe beeped softly again. He retrieved it from the terminal. The tiny display showed success in copying the data. He slid the clothes back where he had found them, surveyed the room to ensure it was exactly as he'd found it, then let himself out the door and locked it behind him. Cade came to his senses to the sound of his slate chiming at him. It was the insistent chime, the one that signaled a real-time connection request from one of his high-priority contacts. He rolled off the bed and got it. Sam was sitting upright, watching him. Incoming video call from Ilyana Alexander. Accept? Yes? No? It's Ilya, he said to Sam. Can I take it?
Go ahead, she replied. But you can't tell her anything.
Cade nodded grimly. He hit Y, angled the slate such that Sam wouldn't be visible. Ilya's face appeared on the screen.
Cade, I'm so glad you answered. Are you okay?
Hey, Ilya. Yeah, I'm fine.
You look like shit. I heard you were mugged.
Yeah, it's true. How'd you hear that?
Someone posted it from the conference. Grad student mugged last night. Also that he had a great poster. Also that there was an explosion and a double murder in Bangkok near where he was mugged. Any connection?
Cade sighed, aware that Sam was watching him. Only to the poster. I think they mugged me because they didn't like my graphs. Ilya chuckled.
How are you holding up, Cade?
Good. The mugging sucked, but, you know, the conference is going well. I met Professor Shu.
Yeah? What's she like?
He hesitated. She's charming. Really charming. She invited me to come out to Shanghai, maybe in August or so. She might invite Rangan, too.
Oh, aren't you the jet-setter?
Cade chuckled in return.
You really okay, Cade?
He forced himself to smile. Ilya would know that he couldn't tell her anything useful. She was just calling to let him know that she cared. She was calling to lend him strength. Yeah, Ilya. Thank you. I'm really okay. She looked skeptical.
Okay. I'll let you go, I guess. Sorry to call so late.
The screen said 1:12 a.m. It must be, what, noon back home? 11? No problem. She smiled at him. His heart melted. He missed her. He missed Rangan. He would find a way out of this. He would. She reached forward to disconnect. Ilya, hold on.
Sure, Kate. What's up?
How could he express this? How could he say this without getting at the issues he couldn't talk about? Issues he didn't even want Sam to clue into. The world was going mad around him. What he wanted was a check on his sanity. Ilya, it's really pretty intense here. There's a lot of stuff you don't see in the States, you know? Really provocative stuff. Ilya nodded.
Yeah? I hear Thailand is that way.
He still didn't know how to approach this. He tried. Ilya, in your essays, you talk about increasing access to transhuman tech. You talk about all the upsides. Do you ever worry about it being misused? She nodded.
Yeah, Cade, of course. We've talked about this. Everything gets misused sometimes. People will do all sorts of nasty shit with transhuman tech. But through history, when people have had the chance to use technology to improve their own lives, they've done a lot of good along with the harm. The good has more than outweighed the bad, dramatically so. That's the only reason we're here today.
Cade nodded. Yeah. He wanted to ask his friend directly what he should do. He couldn't do that. Couldn't give any of this away. Not with Sam right there. Not over an ordinary video call, over an ordinary slate. What about... What if only a few have it?
You mean if only the rich have a technology? Only the powerful? Or only the elites?
Cade nodded.
Broad dissemination and individual choice turn most technologies into a plus. If only the elites have access, it's a dystopia. The worst events in history, the worst atrocities. Maybe half of them arose directly because the powerful had a monopoly, or a near monopoly on some key capability.
Cade nodded. Yeah, that's what I thought you would say. She peered at him.
You sure you're okay, Cade?
He smiled. Better all the time, Ilya. Thank you. Thanks for calling. She smiled at him. He could see the worry in her eyes, but she did her best. He wished he could touch her mind.
I love you, Kate.
She smirked at him.
Like a brother, I mean. I know Rangan loves you too.
Something relaxed inside him. Some tiny fraction of the tension in his body dissipated. I love you too, Ilya. Both of you. Tell Rangan I said so. She smiled. The call ended. Cade lay back in the bed. He had known what Ilya thought, but it was good to hear it again. He would follow the path she would choose, as soon as he figured out how. He heard Sam resettle herself into her bedroll on the floor.
Cade?
She said.
Yeah?
Don't get any stupid ideas.
Watts slid the probe into his own terminal, opened the files to view them, encrypted. The data from Tuxin's phone and terminal were completely encrypted. He'd expected that. He inputted the print pattern he'd lifted from the scanner, still encrypted. A password required in addition. He frowned in annoyance. He connected to a site he knew in Mumbai. He spent a moment specifying what he needed, entering in the parameters of his problem, and then submitted the request for a bid. A few minutes later, the bid came back. He whistled softly. It was high. He had the funds to pay it, but it was a non-trivial amount of money. This trip was rapidly exhausting the remaining balance of the settlement the Corps had given him. He paused for a moment, weighing his options. It was really no choice at all. He was committed to this course of action. More money could always be found later. He accepted the bid, uploaded the data. 2,000 miles away, a server in Mumbai received the data he transmitted. It analyzed the problem, broke it down into pieces, broke the pieces down into fragments, broke the fragments down into shards, and then distributed those shards to its worker devices. Around the world, a network of more than 2 million compromised computers, slates, phones, gaming rigs, VR booths, and other devices, all operating unbeknownst to their owners, received their instructions and began to explore the space of possible passwords, searching for the single pattern that would unlock Jomprom Tuxin's encrypted files. 31. From a friend. Thursday dawned slowly. The alarm was beeping again. Cade slapped it off. Sam was in the shower. She felt pensive. Cade felt numb. He'd left the Serenity package on overnight. Everything about his situation felt distant, unreal. He could see no way to avoid Friday without harming others he felt responsible for. The best he could do was play along with the ERD and hope that nothing bad came of it. The time would come when he would break free. He wasn't sure when or where or how, but it would come. He would bide his time and watch and wait and be ready when the opportunity arose. Sam came out of the shower, clothes already on.
Your turn.
He showered. His bruise was fading. He dressed. They ate in silence. A taxi driven by one of their escorts drove them to the conference. He attended sessions. Sam was with him constantly. One of their escorts was always in sight. When he went to the restroom, an armed man followed him in. At 2:58 p.m., between sessions, Cade saw Somdet Prananda approaching him. He felt Sam tense through the link, felt her awareness of the pistol concealed in the small of her back, the knives in her boots, the positions of their two support shooters, the ceramic guns loaded with graphene-tipped rounds concealed under their blazers. He pushed her paranoia out of his mind, met Ananda's eyes with his own. Sam dropped the link. The senior monk and professor came close, nodded to him. Cade nodded back. He couldn't feel Ananda's mind. He had his own nexus pulled in tight. He had no idea what the ERD would pick up on and what they wouldn't.
Caden, would you walk with me?
Of course, sir. He felt Sam go even more alert.
It's a beautiful day outside. Would you like to walk in the garden?
It was incredibly hot and muggy outside. The rain had been on and off all day. It was anything but Cade's idea of beautiful. Wherever you'd like to go, Professor. Ananda nodded again, then led the way. Cade imagined the Thai mercenaries rushing to keep him in their sights.
I was sorry to hear about your mugging, young man.
Thank you, sir. It was drizzling outside. Cade felt damp and sticky instantly. The garden was a web of interconnecting stone paths winding around green ponds. Low bridges crossed streams. Small stone statues of Buddhas, demons, and gods flanked the paths. Lush green tropical plants filled all empty space. Ananda pointed things out as they walked. A bioengineered carbon sink species that provided ground cover. The symbolism of the patterns the paths made. A 700-year-old statue of a bodhisattva carved by a fallen dynasty.
"Do you know the bodhisattva vow?"
Ananda asked. Cade shook his head.
"It's from the Mahayana school of Buddhism,"
Ananda said.
"Different than my own, but still beautiful. The most basic expression of it is, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. It's a pledge to keep being reborn into the material world of suffering, to put nirvana off indefinitely, until all beings in the universe have attained enlightenment and can also enter nirvana. It's perhaps the ultimate vow of placing others before oneself."
Cade contemplated that. It's a beautiful thought. Had Watts said something similar once, it was a gorgeous thought indeed.
"Another variant I like is, all beings, without number, I vow to liberate." Quite a commitment, eh?
Cade nodded. It is.
"It's been said that Buddhism is the most naturally democratic religion for this reason. The aim of Buddhist orders such as my own is not to control people, but to empower them. You understand?"
"I think so," Cade replied. A memory of something else Watts had said came to him.
"Buddhism suits me 'cause nobody's in charge. Nobody's deciding for me if I'm good or bad, going to heaven or hell. It's just me working on my head, you working your head, the friggin' Dalai Lama working on his head."
"Democracy indeed." Ananda smiled.
"Good, good. In Buddhism, as in, say, science, the goal is to empower people, to learn things of value and import and spread them, so that as many men and women as possible can benefit from that knowledge, can use it to better themselves."
Cade thought of Shu.
"It would be like giving guns to children,"
she'd said.
"There will be a vacuum. You will always be one of the elite."
"What if people aren't ready for it?" he asked. "What if they'd hurt themselves with it, hurt others with it? What if they're not wise enough for it?" Ananda raised an eyebrow.
"Are you wiser than humanity, or by yourself? Is it your place to choose?"
Cade shrugged. "No, and I agree that science should be used to serve the common good, to empower people. But maybe I can see harms they can't. Maybe I've thought through consequences that most people wouldn't. Maybe I just know that a few people would abuse some piece of knowledge, even if the rest would use it for good."
"That is their karma, young man, not yours,"
Ananda said.
"Each of us must walk our own ethical path, and together men and women of ethics can curb the damage of those without. But for you, if you keep vital knowledge from others, then you are robbing them of their freedom, of their potential. If you keep knowledge to yourself, then the fault is not theirs, but yours."
Cade mulled this. "I think I agree with you, mostly." A scientist is responsible for the consequences of his research, Cade thought, both negative and positive. What good is my research if the world doesn't get the positive consequences out of it? But can I do it without hurting people, without making a tool to create slaves and assassins? Ananda smiled.
"I'm glad to hear that, because it can be tempting to hoard knowledge, to use it as a way to gain advantage over others. But if we seek to serve our fellow man, we must spread the things we learn as far and wide as possible. To empower the downtrodden, we must put knowledge in their hands."
Cade looked around at the garden as they walked. "I'm not always sure I'm doing the right thing," he told Ananda.
"Only a fool is always certain,"
the monk replied. Cade nodded again. "Thank you for the advice," he said. "I'll think about that." Ananda nodded.
"I'm sure you will, young man."
He led Cade back towards the conference center, pointing out more plant species along the way, talking about the complex web of life that connected them, telling the stories of every statue, every small bridge, pointing out the beauty in the way the drops of rain pocked the surface of the ponds. When Ananda had gone, when he'd left Cade, slightly damp, slightly sticky, alone in the convention center, Sam opened the Nexus bridge again.
Interesting conversation. What do you make of all that?
I have no idea. But Cade knew he lied. At 3:19 a.m. local time, a lone CPU in a subverted cluster in a data processing center in Kuala Lumpur multiplied two 512-bit prime numbers and found that they were the factors it had been seeking for a 1,024-bit number it had been assigned. It communicated its results to a system in Rio de Janeiro, which passed it to a cutout in Detroit, Michigan, which anonymously forwarded it to a machine in Johannesburg, South Africa, which finally delivered it to a server in Mumbai, India. The result was checked and rechecked. Everything fit. It was the final piece in the puzzle. 3 minutes later, at 4:22 a.m. local time in Bangkok, Thailand, Watts Slate chimed. It was a message from Mumbai. After 29 hours of cracking and more than 100 trillion processor seconds of computation, the key had been unlocked. Sleep vanished from Watts' thoughts. He applied the key, and the data he'd copied from Tuxin's terminal and phone opened for him. It was in Thai. He invoked a translating filter, searched the data for Cade's name. The first hit told him much. From Tuxin Prarachakana Chantam, Tuxin at thaibuddha.th. To Sukpratnung, Sukpn at tmail.th. Sent Tuesday, 1:38 a.m. local time. GMT plus 7. Subject, re, something of interest.
Sukh, the first half of the payment has reached my accounts. Here's the information. The name is Caden Lane. Ananda detected immensely strong nexus activity from him and tasked me to investigate. He believes Lane has absorbed it permanently, but at levels far beyond any we have seen. He is no meditator. He may have the technology you seek.
Well, well, well. An hour later, he pushed back from his slate, whistling softly, piecing it together in his mind. The tall, angular monk named Tuxin, that he'd encountered twice now, the special assistant to Professor Samdet Prananda, was secretly on the payroll of Sukpratnung. And what Sukpratnung wanted, more than anything, was upgrades to Nexus. Ananda had sensed the Nexus in Cade's brain and assigned Tuxin to follow him. Tuxin had sold that data to Sukpratnung, and Sukpratnung had used it to arrange the ambush in the alley, unaware of Samantha Katarane's and her abilities. But it was the last message from Suk to Tuxin that worried Watts.
The same luck that placed him in our grasp on Monday evening is returning him on Friday. He has struck a friendship with people I know. We will grab him and the girl as they leave the event. The girl is dangerous, but we are now prepared. She will be of value, either alive or dead. Sukh.
So, Friday night was a trap.
Could he use that to extract Cade?
No, too dangerous. But he couldn't let Cade just walk into it, either. His first priority had to be keeping his friend alive. He connected to a distributed anonymization service through an entry node in Switzerland. His signal was bounced around volunteered nodes around the world until it reemerged on the public net from a node in Sao Paulo. From there, he jumped to a throwaway machine in the Cayman Islands. From there, he created a fresh email account on an anonymous mail service in Sweden.
The Friday night event is a trap. They'll try to abduct you with more force this time. Leave Bangkok. It's too dangerous for you. A friend.
He set up demons on the email account to inform him of any attempt to hack it. Then he sat back and waited. 32. Preparations. Sam woke to someone paging her slate. Garrett Nichols. She padded into the bathroom, turned on the shower for background noise, and answered.
What's up?
There was another chime. Becker came online, his strong square face filling up half the screen. It was 6:24 a.m. Sam's time, 7:24 p.m. Becker's time. They were on nearly opposite sides of the planet. She could see he was still in the office.
What's the situation? Becker asked.
Nichols answered.
20 minutes ago, Lane received an email from an anonymous account telling him that tonight is a trap.
The message appeared on screen. Sam absorbed it.
Who sent it? Becker asked.
We don't know, sir, Nichols replied. Anonymous account. We can try to backtrack, but if they have any sense, it'll be difficult, and it could also give us away.
Do it, Becker said.
Yes, sir.
What's our operational strength for this mission?
12 combat assets in-country, not including Blackbird. All local contractors approved by CIA.
Mercenaries, he didn't say.
Second-generation combat enhancements.
Becker nodded. The Boca Raton held a platoon of Marines, but deploying them would require authorizations they didn't have. The mercenaries would have to do.
Deploy them all. I want as many of the assailants as possible taken alive. They could lead us back to Prat Nung.
Yes, sir.
You said you can stop them from self-destructing?
It's possible, sir, based on data picked up by Agent Catarane's phone. We think we know the self-destruct frequency and code. We can jam that.
Good, Becker said. Anything else?
Nichols spoke.
Sir, I think we should reconsider Lane's role in this.
Becker narrowed his eyes.
Don't tell me you're going to give me the Lane is a civilian line as well.
Sam kept her breathing steady. Becker wasn't going to get a rise out of her today.
No, sir,
Nichols answered.
But he's an important asset. He's key to getting closer to Shu. It may not be wise to risk him tonight.
And you, Catarones?
Becker asked.
Sir, Special Agent Nichols took the words right out of my mouth.
Becker's eyes flicked down, scanned the message again.
Acknowledged. We have to balance that against the possibility of capturing or neutralizing Ted Prat Nung, and Lane is not irreplaceable if Shu is going to invite Shankari as well.
He paused for a moment, drummed his fingers.
Agent Catarones, your top priority is to keep the asset alive. This message advises us of another abduction attempt. That should make your job easier. Special Agent Nichols, make sure the assault team also understand the priority of keeping Lane alive. We should be starting with non-lethal rounds and escalating to lethal fire only if absolutely necessary.
Nichols nodded. Sam remained silent. Becker went on, more gently this time.
They'll be expecting just you, Sam. They'll up their firepower to be sure they can handle you. They won't be expecting a dozen fully armed operatives. The advantage will be ours.
Yes, sir,
Sam said, her tone completely flat.
And delete that email from Lane's account. There's no reason to spook him. You both have your orders? Becker out.
His face disappeared. Sam rubbed her eyes.
All right, let's talk details.
Garrett Nichols said. At 6:47 a.m., Watson Cole's demons alerted him that the email account he'd used was under attack. A reply had been received from Lane's account. It contained a known Trojan horse attack. Opening it would hand over control of his account and systems to the attacker. 45 seconds later, a bank of servers began issuing log-on attempts to the account. 1,000 of them per second. Someone was trying to hack into his account. Disappointing. Watts disconnected from the mail system in Sweden, then issued the commands to completely wipe the machine in the Cayman Islands. The cyber attack meant that the ERD had read his mail first, and their response suggested that they didn't mean to heed his warning. Watts stood up to his full height and stretched. Joints cracked in his thick neck, his beefy shoulders. He looked down at his massive arms, his dark brown skin, his superhumanly strong hands with their light palms, and contemplated his near future. These hands had killed before, many times. Was he willing to kill again? Yes, if he needed to, he would kill. What would that do to his karma? It was too late for that. His karma was as dark as could be. If he would suffer so that Cade might live, so be it. If he would send himself into an even deeper pit of hell that the world might be a better place, so be it. He turned his hands over, studying them. Somewhere beneath his skin, DNA was slowly unraveling. Somewhere, the seeds of cancers were being sown.
We're all born dying, Watts told himself. What matters is only what we do with the instant we're given.
He'd doomed himself already. The world could still be saved. It was time to collect his weapons and make his preparations. This was going to be a loud and bloody night. In the command center aboard the Boca Raton, an hour after he'd signed off with Catarones, Nichols received another call from Becker.
Sir?
I wanted to confirm with you. The other asset, the November asset. He's operational?
Yes, sir, though...
Yes, Special Agent Nichols?
I still think Agent Cataranis should know about the November asset, sir.
What she doesn't know, she can't spill, Becker replied. The November program may have a very long lifetime. We're under strict orders to keep it to a minimum of disclosure.
Yes, sir.
Nichols bowed his head. Good. I've cleared my Friday schedule. I'll be online with you and your team for most of it. Get some rest. Tonight, I need you at your best.
Yes, sir.
Becker signed off. Nichols sat alone in the command center, restless and troubled. Cade sat on the bed in their room at the Prince Palace Hotel. It was 9:20 p.m. Soon he and Sam would activate their implanted memory sets. His had been updated by 2 rounds of hypno today. He'd forget that he was here on false pretenses, that Sam was an ERD agent, that his friends back home were in danger, that someone had attempted to kidnap him 2 nights ago, that Su Yong Shu intended a post-human revolution against humanity, and more. He would be the Cade of 2 months ago, innocent, unbloodied, shy, nervous, optimistic. That idea should appeal, he thought. It didn't in the slightest. He'd pushed through the final day of the conference today, Sam and a member of their backup team constantly near him. He'd seen Narong, finally. The Thai student had greeted him and Sam and said he was looking forward to tonight. Cade had the urge to warn him, even with Sam there. He didn't. He found the logic inescapable. If he warned Narong, friends back home would be harmed for certain. If he didn't warn Narong or the others, they might all still come through this unscathed.
I have to think strategically now, he thought. I have to wait for my chance. It'll come.
Cataranes came out of the bathroom. She had makeup on. They'd have extensive support, she'd assured him, but he could tell that something about this mission didn't sit well with her. She claimed it was just normal pre-mission adrenaline. Soon, he wouldn't remember or care. He'd be a different Cade altogether.
Time to go,
Sam said. Briefing. We find that the Constitution guarantees protections only to human persons. Non-human persons, such as those created by the combination of non-human genes with human genes, by the integration of technology that affords non-human abilities, or by any significant deviation from the existing spectrum of human characteristics, are afforded no special protections. As such, Congress and the states may legislate the status of non-human persons without regard to the constitutional protections afforded to humans. Dyson v. Department of Homeland Security, Supreme Court of the United States, 2036. This court has committed a great crime today. To assert that a living, thinking being of any sort is deserving of no rights is to ignore the lessons of 260 years of democracy. We invite tyranny, atrocity, and slavery with this judgment. Justice Elena Martinez, dissent in Dyson v. Department of Homeland Security, 2036. 33. Synchronicity. The cab dropped Cade and Robin off near Soi Samahan. Narong and Saja met them, walked with them to the Buddha's Kiss. Everyone was in a good mood. He could feel Robin's mind buzzing, excited. He couldn't wait for the synchronicity trip to begin. Saja led them up a flight of stairs to a heavy door, bolts unlocked. Juan grinned and waved them in. They filed into a spacious living room. Low furniture surrounded an open center space. A patterned carpet in gold and browns covered most of the floor. A half dozen men and women from the previous night at the club sat on small cushions arranged in a circle. A low altar occupied the center of one wall, under a gorgeously ornate window. One side of the room connected to an open kitchen and a hallway. Buddha paintings took up another 2 walls. A wizened Thai woman came in from the hall, a warm smile on her face.
Acharya,
Narong said, their hostess. He introduced them. There were hugs all around. A ritual would start the trip. They were waiting for just one more person. Charya suggested they take seats in the ring of cushions on the floor. They found two open cushions between Narong and Lalana. They sat with Robin on the left by Narong and Cade on the right next to Lalana. Lalana giggled and said hello to them both. Her hand lingered as she clasped Cade's. There were 11 of them in the circle now, including Cade and Robin, 5 young men and 6 young women. Cade recognized them all from the party at the Buddha Kiss on Monday night. Juan, Saja, Narong, and Losan were the males. Lalana, Rajni, Sarai, Ning, and Ariva were the females. One spot in the circle was empty. In the center of the circle there were 2 cushions. An old man sat on one, in lotus position, facing the altar, away from Cade and Robin. Charya came and sat in the other, back to back with the old man, facing towards Cade and Robin.
"Come closer, everyone," she beckoned. "Bring the circle in as close as we can."
They shuffled forward until the circle was snug and close. Cade's knees touched Robin's, touched Lalana's. It was delicious, distracting. He could feel Charya's mind, just barely, a whisper of peace and calm. And just beyond her, Niran, her husband, strong, proud, tranquil.
"Empty your mind of all things,"
Charya intoned.
"Close your eyes. Feel your breath as it enters your body. Feel your breath as it leaves your body. Seek not to change it. Simply observe."
Cade breathed with her, felt and heard the room breathe also. A sound came. The door opened. He kept his eyes closed.
"Sukh,"
he heard Charya say.
"How nice of you to join us."
"Hello, auntie,"
said the new voice.
"It's nice to see you too."
Cade felt a flutter of displeasure from Charya.
"Since you haven't taken a seat yet,"
she said,
"you can serve the rest of us."
"Yes, auntie."
He heard footfalls. Someone walked past him. There was a tinkling. More footfalls. Someone made a swallowing sound. The tinkling was just in front of him.
"Here,"
someone whispered, the new voice. Cade opened his eyes. The newcomer was crouched in front of him, offering him a small glass filled with a silvery metallic liquid. Cade nodded his thanks, took the glass, and drained it. More nexus mixed with empathic. He closed his eyes again, went back to focusing on his breath.
"Watch your breath leave your body,"
Charya intoned slowly.
"Watch it enter again. Let your breath fill your attention. Let it expand to take up all of your mind. When thoughts arise, simply smile and bring your attention back to your breath."
Cade let the breath fill him. The sound of it filled his ears. He felt his body contract as he inhaled, expand as he exhaled. The darkness behind his eyes stretched to the sides as breath flowed into him, narrowed as the breath flowed out of him. He became aware of a sound, a soft chanting, a gentle drumbeat. He watched the rhythm of his breath adjust itself to the soft beat of the drum. The entire room breathed as one, their inhalations and exhalations synchronized.
"Open your palms,"
Charya instructed,
"and gently take the hands of those to either side of you."
Cade reached out slowly to his left and right. He felt Robin's strong hand close around his left, Lalana's small, soft hand slip into his right. There was something electric about the contact. He felt a circuit close, a circuit of thought. It was faint still, but a ripple of sensation flowed through him, an awareness of the minds of the others in the room, an awareness of their breathing, an awareness of their awareness of him and each other, an echo, a resonance, a vibration of breath and mind.
"We are students of the Buddha,"
Charya intoned. A dozen voices echoed her. "We are students of the Buddha," Cade joined them.
"Ours is the middle path,"
she said slowly.
"We seek enlightenment for all beings, to help all beings free themselves of suffering."
The room echoed her with each utterance.
"Tonight we penetrate the veil of Maya. We pierce the illusion of separation between self and other. We apprehend our unity with one another."
Cade repeated every phrase in time with the others. It was hypnotic, euphoric. The veil of Maya, god of illusion and false isolation, was falling from his eyes. He was Cade. He was Robin. He was Lilana. He was Mother Charia. He was Father Neron. He was male. He was female. He was all of them, all things and all people. Buddha looked down on him with a half-smile, serene, content, a man, a role model, who'd apprehended that no god or angel, no demon or devil could bring heaven or hell to man. Only right thought, right action, right effort, right concentration, only the actions of a person, only the striving they made, only the insights they gleaned could ever lead to their enlightenment. He knew this room well. He'd meditated here dozens of times, hundreds of times, thousands of times. He was all these people, all their experiences. He had been a monk, a nun, a prostitute, a student. He'd first encountered Nexus 4 years ago, 6 years ago, 3 years ago. He devoted his life to service, to compassion, to enlightenment. He'd sold his body again and again. He'd studied the mind in the abstract, wanted to feel it tangibly. He'd found a way. He was Aunt Charia. He was her husband, Neron. He'd been monk and he'd been nun. His decades of meditation had stilled his mind. He'd encountered the sacrament, had become one with the other, had crossed boundaries into forbidden territories. He'd left the order, begun something new. Compassion for all life filled him. The universe cried out in pain, in the illusion of division. He was called to teach, to spread love, to release beings from their bonds of craving and aversion, to teach them that all was one. He was the Buddha. He was all of them here. The 14 of them together. Together, they were something more, something amazing. They were the universe observing itself. They had achieved enlightenment. They could spread it to the world. He was the sun. His radiance filled space. His golden rays bathed the earth, sustained all life. He was the wind that blew the leaves, and he was those leaves as well. He was the seas that ebbed and flowed and roared and surged, and he was the fish that swam in those seas, the plankton that they ate, the sunlight falling on those waters. He was the earth. He was the stars. He was all of creation, and he was at this very instant so much alive and so much apprehending his own self. The universe was waking in this very room, and thus it was waking everywhere all at once. Cade opened his eyes. He was trembling. They were all trembling, all panting with quickened breath. Sweat stood on his brow. Robin's hand pulsed rhythmically in his left hand. She felt serene, joyous, completely in her element. Lilana's small hand fluttered like a hummingbird's wings in his right. She felt excited, exultant. How long had it been? 3 hours! It had felt like mere minutes. It felt like eternity. The tempo was easing now. Charia was chanting softly. Neron was tapping the drum ever more slowly. Breathing was slowing, returning to normal. Faces wore smiles. Chests were still moving rhythmically. He glanced to his right. Lilana's breasts rose and fell under her white shirt. Her nipples were hard against the thin fabric. The olive skin of her throat, of her chest where her shirt was unbuttoned, glistened with sweat. It was the most erotic sight Cade had ever seen. He couldn't understand why their clothes were still on, how they could do this and not have it devolve into skin on skin, lips on lips, body on body, why they would want anything else at all. The thought leaked out. Cade blushed. Lilana giggled in voice and mind, and the circle caught it, amplified it, tittered as one, not unkindly, and the tension was broken.
"That was awesome,"
Narong whispered out loud. Cade felt it. The circle had never been that intense before.
"It's me,"
he thought.
"Me and Robin. The Nexus 5.
Charia was looking at him. Her eyes met his eyes. Her mind met his mind.
"Yes,"
her mind seemed to say.
"Who are you, child?"
There was just one mind that felt anything other than joyously open. Suk. He was so distant from them. Why? Someone tapped him on the shoulder. Losan. He was grinning, exultant, crouched beside Cade.
"I felt what you've done with Nexus. It's in you all the time, isn't it?"
Cade nodded, not yet ready to trust his voice.
It's amazing,
Osan said.
Will you show us how to do that?
Something felt wrong. There was something he should fear. But why? Knowledge was to be shared, not hoarded. Why not share some of it now? Cade nodded.
Yes.
It came out husky.
Yes, I'll show you.
It came out fine this time.
Give me a couple minutes.
His body had needs. Osan grinned even wider, radiated excitement and curiosity.
Yeah.
Cade rose, waited in line for the washroom. Lalana got in line behind him, brushed her body against his for just a moment. Cade nearly groaned in desire. He didn't know the rules here, didn't know what was okay. He felt for her intentions, found an amusement there. She pushed him against the wall, pulled his face down to hers, kissed him passionately, playfully. He was so hard. Lalana felt it against her thigh, reached down and put her hand on the lump in the front of his pants, squeezed his hardness through the fabric, pumped him up and down, once, twice, three times. Then she laughed and pushed away from him.
Later,
she whispered. Her eyes and thoughts promised sweet delights. He mock-groaned in frustration. She laughed at him again, and he couldn't help but laugh as well. The combined nexus and empathy